DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress. Today on the show, the people of southern Mali fall on hard times. How Egypt's film industry reflects the country's political upheaval.
We as artists and filmmakers are trying to turn our revolution into a cinematic revolution. We are trying to revolt using cinema.
And meet Indonesia's Bob Dylan, Iwan Fals.
From the moment I started to today, I've never wanted to be boxed in to doing a single type of music. But I never like to see people treated badly. That's why my songs are the way they are.
For this and more, stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. The economic impact of the crisis in Mali is being felt across the West African nation. A coup in March led to an occupation by Al-Qaeda-linked militants in the north of the country. Foreign embassies are advising against all travel to Mali, crippling its once-thriving tourism sector. Many foreign NGOs have shut down operations, and Malians are facing job losses alongside an increase in food prices and household bills. Tamsin Ford reports from Mali's capital, Bamako.
Abubakar Siniyoko sits in the shade of his carpenter's workshop drinking green tea. Usually his 20 workmen are busy with the big heavy machinery, crafting furniture and handmade goods for customers all over Bamako. Not today. In the last few months, Abubakar has let 18 of his men go. There just isn't enough work coming in.
We work here. We do beautiful work. We're skillful. We do many things and can create a lot of things, but we don't have the means to buy the wood.
He's worried about unpaid electricity bills, school fees for his 12 children, and has no idea when or if the next order will come in.
It isn't easy. School isn't being paid. This month they might be sent home because I haven't been paying fees for 2 months. Since the beginning of term, there is no money, so they will come back home and sit here.
After the March coup, minority Tuareg separatists, nomadic herders who have fought for independence for more than 50 years, took control of the north of the country. They were soon moved out by Al-Qaeda-linked rebel groups who swept through the vast cattle-herding desert, accused of looting, raping, and imposing strict forms of Sharia law. Thousands of people have fled, losing their jobs and their livelihoods. And even those who were not uprooted by the conflict face a difficult time. The government has written off as unrecoverable more than a quarter of the targeted revenue for this year, slashing spending plans.
The crisis in the north is causing lots of problems here. We the people, with lots of children, when there's a crisis in our country, we the fathers, it causes a lot of problems because the business is not working. And what I wish today is for the northern crisis to be over. Really, that's what I wish for.
In front of Abubakar's workshop on the busy main road, only two of the tailors at the clothing store have come in today. There isn't enough work for the others. It's the wedding season, usually the busiest time of year for tailors. But with less money circulating throughout the country, people have less to spend. And if people aren't spending, businesses like this one suffer.
So if my business is not working, it will affect my own family.
Dallas Aninta is the owner. She used to go to New York and Paris to buy clothes and jewellery to sell in her shop, keeping up with the latest trends. But she doesn't have the money to do that anymore.
In Africa, you have to support your parents. So if the business is not working, so it will be a shame. I can say a shame and a pity for me.
Dalla runs three businesses. The clothing shop, Top de Elegance, a small taxi service, and a restaurant, Fast Food Dalla. We walk next door to the restaurant. It only opened in February, a month before the coup. Business was going well last year, so Dalla invested her money here, her third business. Something she says she now regrets. It's lunchtime, but there isn't a single customer at any of the neatly arranged tables. The carefully placed orange tablecloths remain untouched. Dalla reaches for her account books to show me the decline in customers since she opened.
You see? What they paid me, I write everything. Everything. For example, this is what I have this month.
So these are the number of customers.
Mm-hmm.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm. The cafe was bringing in around $50 a day, but now she says it makes barely enough to pay the bills and her two staff.
The crisis affected my business a lot because of the lack of money. The customers don't come. They don't come, so there are only few customers because of the lack of money. People don't have money, and the country is not working.
250 kilometers north of Bamako, in Ségou, Modibo Balo stands beside his brightly painted panas, a wooden boat handcrafted with a swooping wicker canopy. Ségou is the capital of the ancient Bambara kingdom and the start of the tourism trail in Mali. From here, tourists can travel down the river through the arid lands of Mali to Mopti and Gao, finally reaching the magical and historic region of Timbuktu. Modibo Balo has been taking tourists out on the wide, stretching Niger River for more than 12 years.
And how many tourists have you had in your boat today?
Today we didn't get any tourists.
And yesterday?
Yesterday, no tourists.
So when was the last time you had a big group of tourists?
Last time it was in the last February. From that time to now, there is not any tourist who's coming here now.
It's a similar story all over Ségou. Hotels are laying off staff or closing down altogether. Boutique riverside restaurants are empty, and the tourist guides and craft sellers sit around drinking green tea with little to do. Ousmane Agrissa is the Minister of Handicrafts and Tourism in Mali.
The impact is a pretty severe one because the tourism companies have hugely suffered from the effects of the crisis. Since there are no more tourists coming, there is no income generation. The guides aren't working anymore because there are no tourists to guide.
Tourism is Mali's third biggest revenue generator. Coupled with widespread job losses, as well as the rising food and gas prices, the impact of the crisis is affecting everyone all over the country. Back in the capital, many, like Dalla, are pinning their hopes on outside help, be it negotiations or military intervention, something to give them belief that these hard times will not last forever.
I just want the international community to help Mali because Malian people need their help and they have to help us.
For DW, this is Tamasin Ford in Bamako, Mali.
We're moving northeast on the African continent for our next report to Egypt, which has seen more upheaval in the last few weeks. Egypt's current political situation also has a big impact on the film industry in the region. The Cairo International Film Festival was held recently, the first since the country's revolution. It was quite a controversial event. Not far from the venue where the films were screened, protesters clashed with police. Actors and others involved in the film industry have a permanent encampment in Tahrir Square, and they are fierce critics of Egypt's president, Mohamed Morsi. Richard Dubel has more.
The Egyptian film industry is the strongest in the Middle East and the most significant in terms of output of films. It is also the most widely viewed in Arab countries and on the African continent. But over the years, the Egyptian film industry has become best known across the region for its soaps, love stories and action movies. Even though it has lost some of its edge along the way, the importance of the Egyptian industry is represented by its annual star-studded International Film Festival. This year, it was put back by a day to avoid clashing with a mass protest in the nearby Tahrir Square. But so controversial was this year's festival, and so divided the film industry as to whether it should be held or not, that the repercussions are still being felt. This year, the festival was a rather muted affair, with Egyptian actresses on the red carpet wearing black dresses as if in mourning, less perhaps for the loss of the old certainties of the surefire hit of the rather hackneyed comedy than for the immediate threat to the film industry. In fact, many in the film industry feel that the festival simply shouldn't have been held at all this year. Wael Omar is a young Egyptian director, and he gives voice to the opinion of many I spoke to.
As much as the organizers have showed solidarity with what's happening in Tahrir, I do feel it's very difficult for the Egyptian contingency in this festival to not to split their loyalties. We're under attack, as in freedom of expression and freedom of creativity is under attack everywhere else in the country, and yet we're going to be used by the Minister of Culture for him to say that, no, we're with here, you know, we're with cinema, we're with freedoms, even look, the Cairo Film Festival is happening and everything is normal.
Wael Omar is one of the directors who has withdrawn his film from the festival in protest. The dilemma for filmmakers is whether to collaborate with the current regime and make the festival a success, or to boycott it. But seeing firsthand what is going on in the region helps support revolutionary determination. Filmmaker and artistic director of the festival, Marianne Houri, comes from a family who've been in the movie business for generations. She says the festival brings specific benefits for local people.
We have the Arab competition, which is a very important competition here because the Egyptian public does not have the opportunity to see films made by the Arab world. In the market here, you see mostly American films and Egyptian films, and you don't have the opportunity to see other Arab films.
Many of the films made in other parts of the region tackle topics like extremism and brainwashing. Tora Bora, a Kuwaiti film by Walid Alawadi, examines the impact of brainwashing on a family whose son is mesmerised by Islamists and taken to Afghanistan. Despite statements in support of the film industry from President Morsi, opponents say he and his supporters are already imposing draconian censorship. Wael Omar again.
The president himself has gone about assuring, as Mubarak used to do, he's assured the cinema community. But at the same time, his organization, they've been doing things like fomenting legal cases against actors for insulting a religion in films, in character. And that's the kind of bullying, really, that we're going to start seeing.
High-profile actors such as Adil Imam have been prosecuted for playing characters who, in the opinion of the Islamists, insult Islam. Egypt is on a knife edge. As the only Arab member of the prestigious International Federation of Film Producers Associations, its position needs to be upheld. Membership of this organisation of leading audiovisual production countries remains a counterweight to a decline in Egyptian cinema, as few investors are willing to risk making films in Egypt because of the political turmoil. This has had a knock-on effect. The drop in the number of films has been compounded by last year's festival being cancelled. Membership is at risk. And as Vice President of the Film Festival, Suhair Abdulkader, says, the film festival is a marker of how the country as a whole is doing.
There can be, لازم كنا ندي positive energy لبعضنا.
The festival has to take place, not for the sake of cinema, but for the sake of the country, its culture and tourism. People from 66 countries have come here to see the festival. They will leave with a good impression about Egypt, and they will spread the word.
Egyptian films such as Ibrahim Batut's Winter of Discontent, which reflects the days leading up to the overthrow of Mubarak, are very popular. And as Karim Al-Adl, a young Egyptian director, explains, filmmakers are using their profession as a tool in the struggle for political power.
We as artists and filmmakers are trying to turn our revolution into a cinematic revolution. We are trying to revolt using cinema. I wish that our revolutionary touch in cinema reaches people, and we hope to continue the revolution, whether it is in Egypt or other Arab countries. The revolution is not over yet.
However, not everyone is as pessimistic. George Saad, a veteran Egyptian actor, feels that the industry should give the new president more time.
The film The Wall of the Heroes, in which I played leader of the armed forces, is a very good film. It was made 5 years ago. At the time, the ex-president, Hosni Mubarak, stopped the screening of this film because he felt that he is the only leader who was victorious in the army. But no, there were many who were victorious in the army. The film today is acknowledged by the army and the government led by Mohamed Morsi. We should give him more time to sort things out.
Critics have been saying that Egyptian cinema was suffering from over-reliance on comedies based on tried and trusted formulae. Few films were at the cutting edge, and other Arab countries were gaining ground. Now there is a new breed of director who are turning current events into film productions, whether documentaries or feature films. It is a development that young directors hope will help the movie industry reinvent itself and become more relevant to the Arab-speaking world.
You're listening to DW's World in Progress. For more globalization and development stories, check out our website at dw.de/globalization. The global campaign to ban landmines is largely a story of success. There is more money available for anti-mine programs now than ever before. But when it comes to financial help for the victims of mines, the figures have dropped dramatically. DW correspondents Claudia Witte and Andreas Grigo report from the International Landmine Conference in Geneva, Switzerland.
It was only 2 months after Margaret Arak-Orek had lost her right leg in a mine accident that she found herself as the representative for Uganda on a Pan-African conference for people with disabilities. The organizers had been looking for a female, English-speaking landmine survivor, and by chance she caught their attention. That was in 1998. As a mother of five, she had just come out of hospital, on wooden crutches and shaken by this latest twist of fate. Making her way to the conference in Harare, Zimbabwe at that particular time and meeting others who had similar difficulties is something she says she will never forget.
The first word I can remember one of them telling me was, "Margaret, welcome to the club." And I laughed. I laughed, but I was having tears in my eyes. And the one telling me, "Welcome to the club," had no legs at all. He said, "Just feel free. You're among friends. You're among one of your own. We are here, we will support you."
Being among other disabled conference participants made Margaret feel understood and accepted, very much unlike back at home. There, her partner and many of her friends had turned their back on her, as they believed she bore bad luck.
They were saying, "How many were you in the vehicle? Why would it have to be you?" I said, "But I wasn't the only one." I said, "But why of all people was it you? Which means I carry bad luck with me." So they didn't want my bad luck to rub onto them.
But Margaret chose to fight. At 56 today, she works as an activist for the disabled and organizes support groups for landmine survivors. At the anti-landmine conference in Geneva that Margaret attended as a guest, Uganda has just been declared landmine-free. The militant Lord's Resistant Army, who was responsible for luring the bus that Margaret was on into a mined ambush in northern Uganda, has moved on. This hasn't given Margaret back her leg, but being in contact with other landmine survivors has enabled her to live with her disability in confidence. Anti-mine activities have proven to be most effective when they involve landmine survivors on all levels of the work, says Lauren Percy of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. This would be especially valuable when it comes to the emotional and psychological support as part of the help to the victims. But that kind of support only goes so far when, on the other hand, there are bills to pay for hospital costs, prosthetics and wheelchairs. In general, 2001 saw the highest flow of funds into anti-mine programs so far, $660 million or €506 million. But finances that go directly into help for the victims, according to Percy, remain something to worry about.
When we look at mine action funding, in fact, victim assistance funding has only been about 9% of total mine action funding. Mine action funding has been going up over the years, and victim assistance funding was slowly increasing as well. It's now gone down by about 30%, so it's about 6% of the total of mine action funding.
Every day, the world sees at least 11 new mine victims. Over the past year, landmines were responsible for the death or mutilation of an estimated 4,200 people. Therefore, demining activities have the highest priority among countries that have signed the Anti-Mine Convention. By joining the so-called Ottawa Convention, these countries pledge to clear their territories of mines within the next 10 years. But not all countries are going to make it in that time frame, which is why at the Geneva conference at the beginning of this month, several have requested an extension for clearing the mines. Much understanding came for the request from Afghanistan, as its delegation was able to offer sound reasoning and a realistic plan of action. On the other hand, Angola, Zimbabwe and Cyprus failed to fully convince the conference that mine clearance is truly their top priority. Yet, they too will be granted an extension. Whenever deadlines are not met, the reasons for this may vary, says Atle Carlsen of the anti-mine organization Norwegian People's Aid.
It's everything from funding to, you know, technological challenges. They need more capacity, more people, or they are in a position where there's conflict in the country. Some countries have used, you know, climate and rain and stuff like that. So there's a range there from very, you know, legitimate causes to not so legitimate causes for not reaching their deadlines.
During the past year, 190 square kilometers, that is over 73 square miles, or an area the size of the city of Stockholm, around the globe were cleared of mines. This might not sound like much, Carlsen says, but it indeed reflects a lot of cumbersome work.
Mine clearance is slow. These are people on their knees in 40 degrees, you know, prodding the earth to, you know, to find a mine. We just have to accept that, you know, it is a bit slow, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
According to current estimates, this leaves another 3,000 square kilometers, or well over 1,100 square miles, globally yet to be cleared.
And our last report today presents a musician who's been referred to as Indonesia's Bob Dylan. His name is Iwan Fals. He has been on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, Indonesian edition, and was named one of Time's Asian heroes. Now, at 51, he's become the country's most famous singer-songwriter. He has put out more than 30 albums and has a new one on the way. And his music serves as a voice for the people against social injustice. Maria Bakalapulu went out to meet this Indonesian music legend.
It's hard to find someone in Indonesia who hasn't heard of the singer Iwan Fals. He's arguably as well known as Indonesia's president and more admired. Just ask anyone on the streets of the country's capital city, Jakarta.
My name is Yanwar. I'm 52 years old. I love Iwan Fals because the music and the lyrics criticize the people who work in the government so those people could be better, so they could do a better job compared to now. I remember listening to Iwan Fals when I was still in high school. I loved him then, and I still do now.
Yanwar lives on the streets, making a living by collecting and selling discarded plastic bottles to recyclers. Despite appearances, he has a liberal arts degree and had an office job until a messy divorce left his life spiraling out of control. Plights like Yanwar's are the essence of Iwan Fals' songs.
Bermacam suku yang berbeda, bersatu dalam cengkram.
Starting at the age of 13 as a busker, he is now a household name. As the voice of Indonesia's conscience, he's a perpetual thorn in the side of government officials. His songs highlight hypocrisy and demand human rights. The lyrics about corruption, the homeless, underpaid teachers, and love are simple, poetic, and honest.
Yeah, saya sambil sekolah dulu, ngamen.
Back when I was a schoolboy, I started playing music in the streets to earn a little extra pocket money. I eventually became a street musician because I really liked that life. I could see a lot of what was happening while on the streets. I would write songs about the things that I found interesting. If ever I was on a break, I'd stop by my friend's stall and read the newspapers that he sold. There were so many stories that I would read about, and they'd inspire me to write songs.
At a recent show in Bali, Iwan Fals played 3 hours straight to a mostly young, flag-waving crowd singing along, punching his fist in the air and yelling out to the crowd. it's obvious that playing live for his fans is where he is most at home. Protest songs such as Bento, a song about thoughtless greed, is a workers' anthem in the country. He sings, "My name is Bento, my house is exclusive, my cars are many, money's no problem."
Sebelum saya jawab itu, gitu.
From the moment I started to today, I've never wanted to be boxed in to doing a single type of music, whether it was political, social, environmental, or love songs. I just want to fill my life and my time with music and songs. I will read about politics, or a friend might lament about something that's not fair in the government. That's the inspiration behind my music. I don't think beyond that. So, since being young, I just love to play music. But I never like to see people treated badly. That's why my songs are the way they are.
His music resonates strongly with the young generation. 22-year-old Gus Bar is a huge fan. He came to Iwan's show in Bali with his father, Gus Bar.
My name is Gus Bar. I love Wan Fal because Wan Fal is a legend. Musical inspiration for my life, very, very good. I still young. My father, my friend, yeah, listening Wan Fal. I love it. The reality in Indonesia, in Bali, in the world.
Iwan Fals is popular with organizations driving social change. He was appearing in support of a People's Credit Union aiding local businesses in Bali.
Economy. Yeah, nggak ada orang bisa hidup tanpa ekonomi.
Economy. Nobody can live without money. But money often gets used in the wrong ways, only to satisfy base human desires. Hopefully, I can inspire ideas which spread wealth more fairly. Then maybe more people can prosper.
Banyak cerita tentang apa aja lah.
Back in central Jakarta at a railway station coffee stall, Andy Chandra plays chess with a friend. He first heard Iwan Fals' music 20 years ago. He feels he is a cultural icon in Indonesia.
So basically, I like Iwan Fals. His song is very strong to push the reforms, talking about the social activities. Sing the song of our reality. We like it very much. All in Indonesia, we love Iwan Fals. We need the more Iwan Fals in Indonesia.
Assalamualaikum!
As Indonesia prospers, the gulf between rich and poor remains. Iwan Fals continues to inspire and entertain. His central theme of people standing up to the abuse of power has not lost its impact. For DW, I'm Maria Bakalapolo in Jakarta.
Sabar, 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 dan tunggu. Itu jawaban yang kami terima. Ternyata kita harus ke jalan. Robohkan setan yang berdiri mengangkang.
Music from Indonesian artist Iwan Fals there to end today's show. And that's all we have for you today on World in Progress. You can check out more globalization and development stories on dw.de/globalization. And you can also download this and other editions of the show as podcast. My colleague Sarah Steffen will be back with the first edition of World in Progress in 2013 at the same time next week. For now, many warm wishes from today's Bonn studio team, Eliane Giarducci, Erhard Bürger, and from me, Anke Rasper. Goodbye, and here's to a happy start for 2013.
Hentikan, jangan diteruskan. Kami muak dengan ketidakpastian dan keserakahan. Jalanan kami sandarkan cita-cita. Sebab